on a Thursday. Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Welcome in, everybody, especially to our Studio Tubers out there.
Hi.
Our Spud Buds, our Tater collaborators, love to have you online. If you have questions about today's show or comments, leave them right there in the YouTube stream. Also, if you're just listening the old-fashioned way, we love you too. You can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org on the following topic.
Yeah.
Online pornography.
Mm.
It has become ubiquitous in the internet age. There are now efforts to restrict access for younger people, Cherry, mm-hmm. including a Texas law that it's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Oral arguments last week. So we thought it was a good time to explore this broader topic of online pornography and specifically how it's impacted young mm-hmm. people. Our question for you, how do you think online pornography has changed how people, especially kids, think about sex and relationships? Again, comment on the YouTube stream, call 888-477-9499 or email us studio2@whyy.org. Two great experts joining us later in the show.
And I have to say, I visited a few porn sites this morning.
What?
On my phone. What? For research purposes. For research purposes.
I'm glad you said that because we're trying to have an open conversation.
Yes.
Here.
And we got to be okay with talking about this.
Yes.
And it had been a while since I've been on the site, but mm-hmm. I was surprised at how easy it was to access the material for free with just a click of a couple of screens. And it took me back to the 90s when I was growing up. And you know, it was harder to get access. I mean, you had to sneak into the uncle's porn collection
right.
in order to get access to that type of material. So times have changed, which is why we're having this conversation.
You know what? I feel like you just liberated our listeners to be open and honest. I really do appreciate that. I can't reciprocate because I didn't do that this morning, but I do
did it for research purpose. I took the L.
I am legitimately thanking you for that.
Yes.
I think it sets the right tone because mm-hmm. that's what we want today. We want people to talk about this because we know people are doing it, mm-hmm. especially young people.
Yes.
And yet we're not really talking about how it's changing the way people mm-hmm. view sex and relationships. So let's talk about it today. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. First, a trio of local news stories. Start us off, Cherry.
Yeah. Under a new Trump administration rule, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a.k.a. ICE, is now free to go into churches, schools, hospitals, and other once off-limit places to detain undocumented immigrants. So, and I want to explain why this is important, because during the Obama years, ICE had a policy that they would not go to certain protected places and spaces. They wouldn't detain people at funerals. They wouldn't go to colleges. They wouldn't snatch people at rallies, and they wouldn't make arrests or raids in these places. And that was the case during the first Trump administration. And during that time, Avi, I was a reporter. And there were people who were under deportation order that would take sanctuary in churches. And Philadelphia was ground zero during that time. I think between 2016 and 2018, about 42 people would hide out in these church spaces. Philadelphia had 14 people hiding out. So, I mean, we're talking about 42 across the country. Philly had 14. So it was a pretty big deal that now President Donald Trump has removed that restriction on ICE, and that, you know, customs ICE agents will be able to go wherever they want. And, you know, Philadelphia has been a sanctuary city. And that's why these churches were having sanctuary or offering sanctuary for individuals. And there's been a big push to have Mayor Parker sort of double down on the sanctuary city
reaffirm it
and be open to taking additional steps to protect the undocumented population. So local advocates like the New Sanctuary Movement, which provided sanctuary to folks previously, they said if ICE knocks, they're not going to necessarily open the door to ICE agents. But, you know, the Trump administration has already said that federal prosecutors will investigate officials who refuse to cooperate with mass deportation efforts. And so this could be a point of friction. It could affect federal funding and other things.
Yeah, my sense just as an observer is that the Trump administration is spoiling for a fight with mm-hmm. some big city mayor, a Democratic mayor mm-hmm. somewhere. Will that be Sherelle Parker? She hasn't said a whole lot yet.
No, she has not.
And we will note that the head of the Office of Immigrant mm-hmm. Affairs here in Philadelphia just suddenly resigned. We yeah. don't have a lot of details about that, mm-hmm. whether that's connected to what's going on at the federal level or not. We just don't know. But I think the big picture question is, will there be that resistance that we saw
yeah.
under the Kenney administration the mm-hmm. first time around? Or will this be a more cautious approach by the city of Philadelphia?
We shall see.
Story number two. Mm-hmm. Does anyone want to buy a college campus? Well, you can. You can, because St. Joseph's University is attempting to sell what used to be the University of the Sciences campus in West Philadelphia. You might remember yeah. that U Sciences and St. Joe's merged a few years back. Again, it was couched as a merger, mm-hmm. but then pretty quickly after that, mm-hmm. St. Joe's said, yeah, we kind of want the students to be on our main campus, which is further out in West Philadelphia mm-hmm. and actually straddles the city line. And now they're just straight up selling the buildings that mm-hmm. used to be the University of the Sciences, a historic school, by the way, basically the first pharmacy school in yeah. the country. It has roots back to the 1820s. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that this was supposed to be a merger, but kind of in the end seems to have just been like an acquisition. And I don't want to say it, but it does look like the outside, like maybe this was a real estate play to like make money off of what is some pretty valuable real estate, because that part of West Philadelphia where U Sciences was it's a hot area right now.
Yeah,
you just can't deny that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see who buys this and for what use, but it's a pretty big real estate transaction in West Philadelphia.
Wow. And this transaction got me to thinking about, you know, all the different schools that have sort of disappeared. Like, yeah. you know, I think about University of the Sciences. I recall covering a conference at the school a few years ago. Now it's gone, right? Buildings being sold off. University of Arts, gone.
Sure.
Building up for sale. We talked about that, the bid for the Center City location. Cabrini University. You know, I spoke to kids in school at Cabrini University a few years ago. Villanova bought the buildings. Now that school is gone as well. Man, it's like some of these smaller schools, you know, struggling with, you know, declining enrollment, gone. And now it's big time real estate. They had prime real estate.
Yeah, big headwinds for higher ed in general right mm-hmm. now. For these small schools, it's tough to survive. What's interesting, though, again, I think about this one is that I would be curious to talk to like people who were at U Sciences when all this went down,
yeah.
because it was couched as a merger. And the idea, I think, at the time was that U Sciences, although part of St. Joe's, would still have some presence in the world. It's basically now being erased from the map. I mean, let's be honest, like
yeah.
no buildings, there's no
Nothing.
Footprint where they used to be. And I'm just curious, the order of events is odd to me.
Yeah.
To say it was a merger. And then within a few years, it really feels like more of like an acquisition and sell off.
Yeah.
I don't
Interesting.
Know.
Interesting.
All right. Third story now.
Yeah.
It's the story everyone's talking mm-hmm. about and thinking about.
The Eagles.
It's on my shirt right now.
Yeah. I did not wear a swag, but Avi did. He has Eagles on his all across his chest right now. The Eagles, as you know, will go toe-to-toe with the Washington Commanders in this weekend's NFC Championship game, which got us thinking about some other D.C. Philly matchups. Because if you don't know this, both Avi and I are originally from the Washington, D.C. area.
Sure are.
And now Philadelphia is our chosen home.
That's right. And I'm on the record, but I want to put this back on the record.
Put it on there.
I'm a lifelong Eagles fan, even though I grew up in enemy territory. But that doesn't mean I don't have a lot of love.
Yeah. And I'm torn, just yeah. so you know, because my dad is and my whole family are Commanders or Washington football fans.
Yeah.
But I love Philly so much that, you know, the only time I really feel this tension is when the two teams go head to head like this weekend.
Tough weekend for you, Cherry
Gold. Yes.
But we're going to play a little game right now.
Okay, let's
so
play.
So our producers have put these little pieces of paper in a Studio 2 mug,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to draw them out at random, and they're going to have two things on them.
Yeah.
One's going to be a Philly thing.
Mm-hmm.
One's going to be a DC thing.
Yes.
And we're going to pick the one that we mm-hmm. like best. Are you
okay,
ready for the
I'm
first
ready.
One?
I'm ready.
This is a food one.
Okay.
Half smoke versus a cheese steak.
I'm going to go with half smoke because I love, and if you don't know what a half smoke is, it was actually created in Washington, D.C. in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's pork. It's like a sausage, a cross between a sausage and a hot dog.
Okay.
And you could chop up onions. You could put peppers. It's so delicious. It's like making a real sandwich on a hot dog roll.
All right. So half smoke. So
I'm going to go with that. Are you going to go with
No, I'm not going to contradict you. If you pick that one, you pick that one.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not saying I would or wouldn't. So you're going half smoke over cheesesteak.
I'm not a big cheesesteak person.
All right, so pick another one.
All right, let's go. Let's, horror film. Okay.
This is a bad category for me.
The Exorcist or Sixth Sense?
I didn't even know The Exorcist was based in D.C.
Yeah, it Georgetown. Is? Yep.
Oh, okay. Bro. I grew up there and I didn't even know that. A Sixth Sense easily. I like something with suspense that's a little less like blah, 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 like blood everywhere.
So you don't like spinning heads?
Spinning heads. Not a big spinning head guy.
And like
talking heads, yes.
And like split pea soup heads. Coming out of a little robot. Okay.
I'm picking the Sixth Sense.
Okay.
It's Philly one, DC one. Okay.
All right. I'm writing this down because my math doesn't always math.
All right. This category is best Kevin. You ready?
Ooh.
DC's or PG's Kevin Durant versus Philly's Kevin Hart.
Ooh.
So Kevin Durant, great basketball player. Kevin Hart, legendary comedian. Who are you picking?
You know what? I'm going to go. I've been going Philly, but I went DC for. I'm going to go with Kevin Hart.
Really?
And the reason
it's a
why.
Much shorter Kevin.
I know. The reason why is because I covered the unveiling of his mural. It was Broad and Erie.
Yeah.
Outside of Max's Cheesesteaks, I think.
Oh, so it's all about you, Cherry Gregg.
I'm just saying he was there and I interviewed him. So it was like cool. And he's really funny.
But Kevin Durant can ball.
He can ball. And he's from PG where I grew up.
That's
so,
right.
High
all right.
School.
All
go.
Right. So Philly 2, DC 1.
Sorry, Katie. so I got
sorry, PG too. No. You just betrayed your home county.
I did. All right. Oh, I bumped the mic. best. Okay. Eccentric mayor, Marion Barry or John Street?
Eccentric to describe Marion Barry. Like, do we want to really go into that backstory? I'm just going to play it safe here and pick John Street because I don't want to talk about the Marion.
Okay. All right. All
right. Did you put that in?
I did.
Oh, my God. That's a trap. That's a trap.
I got Avi. What? God, I'm blushing. Go ahead.
All right. House of Government.
Okay.
White House versus Philadelphia City Hall.
Well, you know, I got to go White House.
I mean, it's hard
it's
to
easy.
Argue White House.
It's easy. It's that's an easy
symbol.
One, yeah.
Okay, so what's the story now? So that's D.C. So it's I think it's 3-2. 3-2 Philly, right?
My math is messed
It's 3-2 Philly.
Okay, 3-2 Philly. Okay, last.
Let's do one more.
Last one. Okay.
It's either going to be a tie or it's going to be.
Uh-oh, I got to open up the thing. Let me see. All right,
maybe
let's
one
grab
more.
One more. Traffic. Beltway versus Schuylkill Hill.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the Beltway, as you guys know, it's the circular road that, you know, goes around D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we know the Schuylkill Expressway. Both terrible.
Terrible for drivers. But
I'm going to go Schuylkill Expressway.
Okay.
And let me tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, for most of the way, you get to look at a pretty river and like Boathouse Row and
look
the city
you.
Skyline. The Beltway is mostly just like walls.
That is true.
It is a slog.
And it's so wide. It can be scary, too.
All right. So I think, did Philly win?
I think Philly won.
Philly 4, DC 2?
Yes. Is this sort of like...
And that's what's going to happen on Sunday, Cherry Gregg.
I am torn. I'm a main torn Commanders fan.
Let it be known.
But, Philly, you know, I wouldn't be mad, though. I would not. I would actually be happy if the Eagles won.
Philly versus everybody.
There you go.
Including the city that stole the nation's capital from us. All right. So coming
He's
up.
Still angry about that. Looking back at history.
I could be salty. I could be salty for centuries, Cherry Gregg.
I love it.
Okay. Our question for you today is about our main topic. Which is online pornography. How do you think online pornography has changed how people, especially kids, think about sex and relationships? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're a studio tuber, drop a comment right there on the YouTube stream, and we'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The internet is filled with porn. It's hard to avoid stumbling on an explicit site or an image. And the same goes for kids. It's hard to control what young people see online. And many report having watched pornography by the time they are 12 years old.
Look, and that worries lots of experts. In recent years, some states have tried to prevent kids from accessing adult content by requiring age verification to enter certain sites. And just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case challenging the new age verification law in Texas. So this hour, we wanted to talk about why porn is so ubiquitous online, how can we protect young people from seeing it, and what impact it's having on their development. We have two great guests with us this hour. On Zoom, we have Debbie Herbenick, who is the director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University and the author of Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex. Debbie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me here.
So happy to have you. And right across the table from me, we have Erica Smith, who is a sex educator and creator of the Purity Culture Dropout Program. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And our question for you, our listeners, is how do you think online pornography is changing how young people think about sex and relationships? You can join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you are watching on WHYY's YouTube channel, drop your comments in the live chat.
Debbie, I wanted to pose this first question to you. I think we all have a sense that pornography is more ubiquitous now. It's maybe easier to access for young people. Is that the only real big change with the internet era? Is it just ubiquity, or are there other things that are changing in this space that you think have had real reverberations?
Yeah, it's a great question. We often talk about how easy it is to access pornography today as compared to decades earlier, and that's true. But it's also the sheer volume of it. It's a massive amount. You know, some people my age often joke that maybe if they found something, it was a single magazine or a magazine here and there, whereas, you know, today you can access thousands of images. And it's also the content. It's what's shown. People who are familiar with pornography from, let's say, the 1990s, if they haven't really seen it in a while, would probably be pretty surprised at the content today, which is much more aggressive than it was decades earlier. And that's not just my perspective as a researcher. That's from people in the industry saying that as well.
Can you explain why it's trended that way? Do we have a handle on why we're seeing more aggressive pornography, as you describe it?
Sure. You know, the limited information we have about the reason why does come from people in the industry, people who make porn. And in different interviews, they have said, for example, over the years that, you know, as it became available on the internet and they had to grab people's attention and keep people's attention, they had to do newer things, bolder things, bigger things, more aggressive things. And so it really did change the way that, you know, pornography is shown, just as the attention economy has changed so many other things in media.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Wow.
I went on a few porn websites this morning, right on my phone. It was so easy. And I was actually a little shocked at some of the graphic images, just some of the very unusual sexual acts being performed that you don't usually see in real life. And so, Erica, my question for you is, if you're a young person, I'm trying to put myself in the mind of a young person and seeing this for the very first time, how do they take in these types of images that are readily available for free on porn sites?
That is another great question. And I think that it's important to remember that a lot of young people don't have adequate information about sex and sexuality in general. So they might not have gotten a sex talk, or they might not be raised in a home where we're talking about these ideas openly. And so when they start to see these images online, they may begin to think that is what will be happening when they become sexually active, like that they will expect that women will act this way, that men will act this way, that pleasure will be given and received this way. And there are other things that you see in some of these videos, which include, you know, lack of a consent conversation, lack of sexual health protection. So it can really give young people a often terrifying idea of what awaits them sexually.
Yeah, and Kelly on YouTube agrees. Kelly says, I think it's changed how young people approach sex or the relationships for their first time, especially when it comes down to causing harm, choking, for example, right off the bat and without consent. Debbie, do you agree with that? Do you think it has changed sexual behavior among young people? And is that provable? Because that's a big question to try to answer.
You know, it's interesting. I think sometimes we researchers can get ourselves into a spot where we want to look at everything in this very empirical way of evidence. And if there's not a randomized controlled, you know, trial, how can you know?
Right.
Well, as a researcher who does, who uses surveys, who uses interviews, who works with people in lab-based research and so on, you know, I can go straight to the source and I hear from my college students. And in these in-depth interviews, when we ask people about their sexual lives and we hear them describe, you know, choking and slapping and sometimes even like punching each other and a whole range of things. And we say, well, where did you first learn about this? The young men, especially, almost always tell us pornography. So they, you know, it's coming from them.
Yeah.
And the young women do say pornography, too. They also talk about social media and they talk about partners who they knew to be watching pornography, doing things to them that they had learned about from pornography. So I think that that is really important to listen to youth voices and what they share with us. And exactly as Erica said, what we very often hear was, this is just what I thought you were supposed to do sexually, right? It's what I saw. And so they get a sense very early on that these are the norms and the expectations for them for when they start kind of making out and hooking up with other people.
I want to play a clip because when I heard this clip, it shocked me. And I'll just say that. And this is a clip of Billie Eilish. She was on the Howard Stern show in 2021. And here she talks about her experience watching pornography online when she was very young. So take a listen to this.
I started watching porn when I was like 11. I thought that's how you learned how to have sex. I was watching abusive porn, to be honest. I think it really destroyed my brain. And I feel incredibly devastated that I was exposed to so much porn. I think that I had like sleep paralysis and these like almost like night terrors slash just nightmares because of it.
And so I want both of you to sort of react to hearing her talk about something very sensitive, having watched porn beginning at 11. And what do we know about what exposure to porn at such a young age does to a developing brain? Do we know anything, Erica?
I want to rely on Debbie for the research part, for sharing what she knows about porn on developing brains. But I think that what I hear in Billie's story is that she also had no context for what she was seeing and should, I mean, first of all, an 11-year-old should never be exposed to pornographic material. An 11-year-old should never see those things. So it's really hard to kind of think about how to even deal with the fact that this is available to children. But I would say that I'm going to go to Debbie because I'm losing my train of thought.
I apologize, Debbie. I know you're our research expert here. So, Debbie, what do we know about early exposure of pornography to people as young as 11, like we heard from Billie Eilish?
So, you know, I am a researcher. I'm not a neuroscientist or a brain researcher. And that work is very much in development. So I think we still need to learn a lot more about the effects on the actual brain itself. But to Erica's point, I think what's really important is we're hearing somebody talk about when they were a child, they were 11 years old. And this is not unusual. Again, the Common Sense Media report shows us, and this is consistent with academic research, that the average age that young people report first seeing pornography is 12. Because that's an average, it means that you've got to have a lot of 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds to maintain that as an average. And yes, you have people in their teens as well. So we have a lot of children, elementary school age children seeing this. And, you know, I'll leave it to the neuroscientists to talk about the brain and its structure, development. And in an adolescence, the brain, by the way, is going through development, like helping to understand empathy and social cues from other people. So there's a lot of ways it can develop, it can affect development. But part of that is if the images you're largely seeing are aggressive, and not just aggressive, but remember in pornography, when they show those aggressive acts, they're going to show the person most of the time looking happy to have those things happen to them.
Yeah.
So for a young person who is first learning about intimacy and sexual expression, they're not just repeating like robots a thing that they saw. They are taking in social information from their environment, which is a lot of it's online, and they're learning that if I do that, that's a good thing, right? And that's the social learning component that we really worry about. So many of my college students for the past several years, so even going up now into people in their mid to late 20s, something I've heard over and over again is they say, I feel like our generation was just like a guinea pig generation,
yeah,
right? Like
yeah,
we
totally
had devices, we had access. And that's really hard, right, to think through how we can do better. And I think we can, how we can do better for the kids who are living right now in those age groups.
Totally. I want to read this comment, a few comments actually I want to read. Here's one from Mary on YouTube who says, I learned about porn from my uncles playing like a movie in the late 1960s, but online porn is too much for the young to handle. But here's like a little bit of a counterbalance from Adam, who emails and says, I think there's a healthy balance for porn in people's lives, especially for those that may not have as many opportunities to have in-person sex and explore this world, thinking about people who live in more isolated communities or people who have disabilities. But we need to reel it in. So that's Adam's perspective. And Erica, I actually wanted to turn that to you because I know you work with a lot of young people who might have grown up in an environment where it's like abstinence only. There's like no inputs for how to think about sex and a healthy sexual relationship. And I'm thinking about the old days where you might have just been exposed to like one movie mm-hmm. or one magazine, and that's your whole frame of reference. And like, is that actually better? Because then, yeah, you're not exposed to maybe as much more extreme images, but you also have very little information to go off of at all.
All of this is a wonderful argument for why comprehensive sex education is important, and that is teaching young people not just about their bodies and what they can expect of their bodies, but also teaching them about how to have healthy relationships with each other and how to communicate with each other. And to the point of the person who commented or emailed Adam, who said like pornography could have a positive place in some people's lives, I too take that position. Mm-hmm. I think that there are ways that people can engage with certain content that can be helpful to them and useful to them. But when it comes to young people, we are not giving them the right, I guess, starting point for beginning to understand what they're seeing. Mm. And a lot of young people don't have anyone that they can go to ask.
Yeah.
So if you're raised in a family where, I mean, most of the time you're not going to want to ask your mom or dad about porn, no matter how cool they are.
No.
But if there's a lot of silence and shame around the topic of sex in general, young people might come across this content and consider it the best form of education.
Right.
They might think, well, this is how I find out what to do when
there's
it comes.
A vacuum, and that's what's filling the vacuum. So you're saying education, like give us an example, because if there is an idea that, I think we all probably think there's going to be some pornography in people's lives.
Yes.
There has been for thousands of years. What is the context that you need to give a younger person so that they know what they're seeing?
So the best advice, and this can be kind of scary to think about for parents, is to actually have a conversation with your children before you believe they've ever been exposed to it. So that can mean starting ideally before puberty, especially if you have young people that might spend time around other teens or young people that have their own devices. So if you've gotten your 12-year-old or 10-year-old a phone and you know that the phone, you open it up and it's a whole world, that is when we really should ideally say to young people something like the following.
A script.
A
I love
script.
It.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a great script. Something like, hey, if you ever come across pictures or videos, or if a friend ever shows you a picture or video and you see people who are naked and maybe they're touching each other's, whatever word you use in your family, they're touching each other's private parts, I want you to know that that is not for children and you should come tell me immediately. And also emphasize to your child that they are not in trouble. So say, like, you can step away from whatever you saw and just come tell mom or dad. And we'll talk about I'll help you understand what you've seen. And that is the ideal way to give your child the sort of a safety where they know they can come to you and ask questions. And also that they did not do anything wrong by this accidental exposure.
Yeah. Creating open dialogue there. And I want to put our question of the day out again. How do you think online pornography is changing how young people think about sex and relationships? You can join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on our YouTube page, you can keep those comments coming in our chat. I want to bring in a caller. We have Jennifer, who's calling in from San Francisco.
Hey.
With a comment. Jennifer, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? And welcome to Philly. I'm glad you're calling in Philly. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be in Philly. I'm Jennifer Berger. I've been at About Face teaching media literacy to more than 10,000 teens through this nonprofit in San Francisco for more than 16 years. And going to school classrooms, giving kids critical thinking skills. I'm calling to say that teaching all forms of media literacy to kids is the only real way to help kids survive and thrive online. I've seen it in action. I mean, porn literacy and sex education is crucial, but we need all media literacy. It's their first exposure to the adult world anytime they get online. And kids just need to know how to understand the red flags, and pairing them with caring adults like their parents is the only way to help make them safer. It's just never going to happen in school. Parents or other trusted adults have to be involved.
Yes.
And my organization is developing the Social Media Driver's License, which is a program that prepares both kids and parents for, in terms of all forms of media literacy, for smartphones and social media specifically.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That's Jennifer calling from San Francisco. That was a great comment because we do need to be more literate when it comes to social media and media generally. I want to ask, how much is too much? Because, you know, you think about it, Debbie, that, you know, kids are curious. Young people are curious. It's not bad necessarily to be interested in seeing pornography or other images. You get curious. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing. But when is it too much? Like, how do you sort of gauge when it could lead to negative behaviors like addiction to porn?
Well, there's nothing wrong with being curious about sexuality. That is something we expect for most older children and teenagers. So just to be clear, right, that's a normative part of development. We can do better about delaying access to devices. We can, you know, help support their curiosity by providing age and developmentally appropriate books at every age and stage, right? If you got your kid books about how babies are made, well, they need something more, you know, if they're 8 or 10 or 12 now. So update the books and support their curiosity that way. If you were to find that your teenager is going online a lot and looking at either concerning material, possibly illegal, material, or things that seem maybe much more aggressive or dangerous, or they are, you know, looking so often and it's getting in the way of their school or friendships, or is beyond what your family agreement was, I strongly encourage parents and teens to create a family agreement together about technology, including sexual material. So if it's kind of gone out of bounds in any of these ways, then you do need to have bigger conversations. Or restrict device access if they won't kind of stick with the rules.
Right. Yeah. We're going to keep our conversation going on the other side of this break. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. I do want to get into the public policy part of this on the other side of the break. What are the proper guardrails? We've heard about age ID verification for websites. Is that the wave of the future? Does it just drive people underground? We're going to talk about all of that on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Stick with us.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you're just joining us, we're talking about internet pornography and its effect on young people today. Several states are moving to restrict access to online porn, and the U.S. Supreme Court may reverse precedent and allow those restrictions to stand. Joining us this hour are Debbie Herbenick, director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University, and the author of Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex. We're also joined by Erica Smith, a sex educator and creator of the Purity Culture Dropout Program.
And our question for you today is, how do you think online pornography is changing how young people think about sex and relationships? You can join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, please leave your comments in the live chat. We started talking a little bit, Erica, about, you know, having that conversation with your children, but we have a culture that is very... it's very awkward. You feel a lot of shame. It seems very taboo to have conversations about sex, let alone porn. How do you create an environment where you can talk about porn literacy? And what is that, by the way?
Yeah. So porn literacy is equipping folks, especially young people, with a set of like critical thinking skills around what they're seeing and what they're consuming and like the meaning that they make of it. So, but how to create the environment where it's comfortable talking to young people about this, it really starts with parents doing some reflection of their own attitudes and values about sex and what they learned about sex. So if you were raised to, you know, if you were also raised in a family that had a lot of shame around it, or that told you, you know, everything was bad until you were married, or, you know, whatever other versions of like sexual ethics are, it's important as a parent to get comfortable with, like, think about what do you think about porn? What do you think about sex? What did you grow up hearing about it? And what do you want your children to know about it?
It's that self-reflection.
Yeah. Very much.
It's got to start with self-reflection.
And being intentional.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really difficult for parents who didn't get their own sex education or their own environment where it was easy to talk about. It can be really difficult to then intentionally parent in a way that I would consider sex positive, where you're giving your children the information that sexuality is a part of life and it can be a healthy, fun part of life. But there's also a lot to know about that.
Mm. Yeah. Can I read this? I'm going to read this comment from Kareem from Newcastle, Delaware, who says, I believe porn exposed me to too many varieties of women and sex acts, which in turn may have given me the desire to have that type of variety in real life. And I think it plays a huge role in some of my challenges as far as losing sexual interest in partners. And so to me, just seeing the end result there is sort of, how do you sort of push the conversation? Because you talked about, Erica, how to talk to someone really young, but how do you have a conversation with an older teen?
Yeah.
Where they may have real questions and maybe engaging in sexual activity.
So this is where porn literacy talking points come in, and they are important not just for young people, but I think for adults who've had a lot of pornography exposure. And some of the this is a sex educator saying that I did not make up, but we like to say, you would not learn to drive by watching the Fast and the Furious movies.
I had that quote written down. It's right here.
That's because a good one.
It's a great quote.
I don't know who it came from, but we say it all the time in this field, is like, the people that are acting in these movies, they are professionals and they are doing things that are very dramatic, and they are doing some things that we would consider extreme, and you were not going to learn how to drive your car or operate your, you know, sexual body by watching these professionals do crazy stuff.
And so it's not a reflection of real life, just like the Fast and Furious is not a reflection of how traffic works,
right?
So how people even look.
So that's the porn literacy comes in, where some of the talking points might be, a lot of folks don't have this kind of sex in real life. Bodies don't always look like this. Women don't always want to do those things you see. People of any gender don't want to do all those things you see. And also, you know, you are not going to see authentic pleasure reflected in some of these videos in the way that women actually experience it. So those are some of the porn literacy talking points.
Interesting. I want to read this email from Liz who says, thank you for taking this conversation seriously. Thanking the two of you. Many of our marriages, relationships, and parenting efforts are vastly changed by the rise of online pornography, and we need these issues brought into the light like you're doing. Let me bring in a caller now. This is Arthur from Bryn Mawr, who is on line 3. Arthur, you're on Studio 2. Thanks for calling in. What's your question or comment?
Well, thank you to Cherry and Avi and all the contributors. I'd like to just say that the focus here seems to be on streamlining the messages for children. And I don't think with all the different kinds of families you can necessarily rely on families to make that messaging, but schooling, yes, age appropriate through the school years, you can probably streamline the messages and include aspects like condom use, bodies, sexuality, safety, and respect and consent, and all those things, including pornography as art.
Thank you so much. That's Arthur from Bryn Mawr. And I want to, we teased this before the break, and I wanted to ask you, Debbie, about public policy. Look, we're not going to solve this today, but clearly some states are trying to solve this by using new technology that allows, it's you know, pretty effective at determining the age of the person trying to enter the site and then restricting the person if they are not 18 or older. Is that a potential solution, or will it have side effects that could make the problem worse? Because we are talking about trying to bring things into the light that could drive people underground. So I could see arguments for either side.
There are arguments on both sides, right? Some companies express a concern that if you require folks to show their age verification, their age ID, that they simply won't go to the mainstream sites and they'll go to these really, you know, more difficult places on the internet, although people are already in those spaces. And also mainstream pornography, as we've discussed, is already showing content that 20 years ago would never have been shown in mainstream pornography, wouldn't have been allowed to have been shown, right? And, you know, 20 to 30 years ago in these videos. So I think like that's a complicated conversation where I think, you know, almost everybody seems to agree, as far as I can tell, is that children should not have access to these materials. And so how do we do that? And how do we do it so that we're not having the same conversation in 20 or 30 more years? It may not be a perfect solution that comes up from all of this, but how do we support young children? Because as our caller just said, this is also not something that every single parent is going to be equipped to do. I've seen this come up in the Supreme Court hearing so far, parents saying, hey, this is difficult. Justices saying, this is not so easy to use content filters on every device.
Yep.
Even if you've got your home locked down, as most parents will say, what happens when they're, you know, with the grandparents for the night or the cousins or they're at a sleepover? And so it's really difficult to ask, you know, many millions of parents to handle this on a case by case basis. And I think many families need some broader support.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Arup from West Philadelphia on the line. Arup, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I'm 29 years old. I grew up very much on the internet. My first pornography, I was probably 11 or 12, and it was actually animated porn. And I met my wife in college, and we both had very similar stories. And we felt that it really hindered us developmentally, and neither of our parents ever talked to us about sex, pornography, being online, none of that. And it felt like we had to kind of teach ourselves everything from scratch, how to have a good relationship, how to be intimate with a romantic partner, how to handle online pornography. So I found today's conversation really valuable, just knowing that this is something that people are thinking about. It's also something that we're trying to think more as we also move into having our own kids, because we truly have no idea how to talk to them once they exist.
That's a great perspective. We talked about this idea of the guinea pig generation. And I think that's what Arup just verbalized.
I know. And I'm thinking, and Robin even has a comment that's similar. She says, the effects of this industry is having a profound effect on adults these days as well, in addition to children. She says, we are normalizing dysfunctional relationships and discouraging healthy sexuality. So how do we sort of encourage healthy sexuality and sort of lift the shade? Because even when we started the show, like just admitting that you went on a porn website this morning, it can be an awkward thing. And so maybe we can open this up a little bit and find a way to find that healthy balance, restrict it from kids, but also be able to have those conversations openly and honestly. And your thoughts on that. And we'll start with you, Erica.
Yeah. So, I mean, we live in a, you know, we're in the United States that is, we're a famously puritanical nation, and our sexuality and the way that especially some of our current political conversations around sex continue to add shame and silence. So it is really an uphill battle for people in the field like me and Debbie. It can be really difficult to try to have these conversations with people and get them to sort of even begin to peel back their layers of shame. But there is really no other solution to helping children and adults navigate a world full of pornography other than talking about it. And it has to be talked about. There's no way around it. For parents out there who like the person who just called in, who is a future parent, my best resource suggestion is the organization called Sex Positive Families. They are wonderful. They do workshops about how to have these conversations with children. And that is starting from infancy, basically, just beginning to have conversations with kids that normalize bodies, that normalize curiosity, and that normalize consent. And then we build on those as kids get older. Yeah.
Debbie, I think you wanted to jump in the conversation and maybe even after that caller to add some perspective. And I'll just turn the floor over to you.
Thanks. Yeah, I think one of the things that the caller made me think about in this conversation in general is the opportunities we have to share what we do want for our kids, not just what we don't want, not just I don't want you watching pornography, although that can be part of it, right? But also, like, I want you to have a sexual life and an intimate life one day, right, when you're older and you're ready or whatever the case is. And I want it to be something that brings you joy. And I want you to feel respected. And I want your partners to, like, embrace you and not be scared of you, right, which is something I hear from my college students. I did this thing, and, like, the person never called me back. So sharing, like, the positives that we want for them. And one of the reasons that I write about in Yes, Your Kid, in addition to the pornography literacy and media literacy and all the other things, is that I think we can say to them, like, I want you to have the space, like with your own body and with your partners as you grow up, for you to figure out what you like and they like, and creating this, like, mutually pleasurable, joyful experience, and not just doing what you think, right, some, like, you have to do because you saw it in pornography or heard about it on TikTok or anything else. So, like, trying to encourage them to have a bright vision for themselves, and that they can get there through their own sexual exploration. And as Erica said, it does take talking. It does take self-reflection as parents and as school board members and all of that to think how we do this. But it is possible to support young people in having a positive vision for themselves as sexual beings who enjoy, like, mutual pleasure one day.
This is sort of a similar comment, actually, on YouTube from Fascism Watch. It says, the hardest part is that parents have to show an example, showing love and promoting a healthy vision of their relationship. And so, I mean, you're talking about it can't just be no, no, no. There has to be some yes in here. And I do worry sometimes, Erica, that people hear a show like this and their takeaway is porn is bad.
Yeah.
They can't see it. Let's not talk about it. And what I hear both of you saying over and over again is, don't take that away from this conversation.
Absolutely. You know, pornography is such a massive topic. There are also people that create content that is for like audiences who did not always see themselves represented in erotic content. So there's a big world out there. So I'm not trying to say all of it is bad. That is not my position at all. But when it comes to the fact that it exists, we just have to think critically about it. We have to be unafraid, or at least push through the fear of talking about it. And, you know, let young people know and adults know that you're going to see things that horrify you. You're going to see things that maybe interest you. You might come across things that you would like to try, or things that you're like, I can't believe people do that. And that's all okay. We're all so individual when it comes to pleasure and sexuality. And like Debbie said, I want people to know that they can have, you know, where the void of no talking about sex or no talking about porn should be filled with good education about how you can have a joyful relationship with your sexuality. And it should be a healthy part of your life that you get to determine. And mm-hmm. it doesn't have to look like it does in porn or even in movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just want to read this comment mm-hmm. real quick from Carrie, who asks, is there such thing as romance porn?
Ooh.
Or is that just soft porn? Are there sites with more realistic and loving sex? Like, real quick, I mean, Erica, does that exist? You said it's a big world. Does
oh,
that
yeah.
exist out there?
It does exist. I mean, there are sites that are primarily user-generated and uploaded content. So a loving, happy couple can make their own film and submit it to a site.
Hmm.
The example site I'm thinking of is called Make Love Not Porn. But these do exist. Hmm. And there are creators out there who are like, they want women's pleasure to be shown accurately. They want all people of all genders and sexualities to be represented, different body types to be represented. So you got to find
there's a
that
lot
stuff.
Out there.
More
yeah.
realistic.
Yes, very.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining the show today and bringing this conversation into the light. Debbie Herbenick is director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University and author of Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex. And Erica Smith is a sex educator and creator of the Purity Culture Dropout Program. Thanks to both of you.
Yes.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Paul Parmalee engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. And after all that, I am Avi Wolfman-Arrett from Studio 2 in Philly.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.